This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
In 1984, in an extraordinary act of compassion and brotherhood, Israel airlifted thousands of persecuted and starving Ethiopian Jews from Africa to Israel. They had been waiting in Ethiopia for millennia, sustained by the hope and the belief that one day they would return home to the Holy Land. Among the refugees was an 8-year-old boy, Danny Adino Abibi. Now an Israeli journalist, Abibi tells the story of his family and his village and the journey they traveled from Ethiopia through Sudan to Israel, and the even longer distance from a rural village life without indoor plumbing, electricity, or books to a modern society. Sadly, many who left the villages did not survive the hardships of the journey, and many of those who did reach the promised land were emotionally wounded in the process. Immigrants in all times and places struggle with loss. They struggle to understand and adapt to their new country, to find a way to fit in, and to expand their identity to incorporate the old along with the new. But few must leap a cultural gap as wide as that which this group faced. In his new country, Adino Abibi encountered both embrace and rejection. He experienced both astonishing support and appalling prejudice. As he matured, he recognized that both attitudes exist among his former countrymen in Africa as well. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Renee Garfinkel, your host on the New Books Network with the Van Leer Jerusalem series on ideas. Please subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform. We're pleased to welcome Danny Adino Abibi to the show today to talk about his book, From Africa to Zion, The Shepherd Boy Who Became Israel's First Ethiopian-Born Journalist. Danny Adino Abibi, welcome to the podcast.
Shalom, Renee. Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Let's get right into your experience so the audience will have some sense of what you and your family and the other immigrants from Ethiopia went through. What was it like to be a Jewish boy in Ethiopia? And what was your parents' experience there?
Well, to be a Jewish boy in Ethiopia, very far from any civilization, no running water, no electricity. I mean, just if you have opportunity, open the first page of a Bible, Genesis. And God created everything, including my village when I was born, and he didn't come back. He didn't return. He was really far, even for God. I mean, to be a boy, a Jewish boy in Ethiopia, in my village, it was like to be a dreamer. My whole life, I dreamed to get to Jerusalem one day. I mean, it was my goal, my personal goal. It was all Ethiopian community dream. I mean, I grew up as a dreamer. I wanted to get one day to Jerusalem. It was my It was my dream. It was my goal. It was my life. And I was thinking always about one thing, about Jerusalem. It was my dream. I mean, I was, you know, I was a shepherd boy when I was a young boy. And I had a very simple position as a shepherd boy. I took my cows, my sheep, my dogs, whatever we had. We hadn't a lot of things, God, thanks God. And I remember myself as a young, I wanted to be here. I wanted to touch Jerusalem. I wanted to be part of Israeli, the Jewish community. And, you know, Renee, I don't know if you know, I didn't know about white people. I was thinking all people around the world, the blacks. And I remember the first time when I saw a white man, I was really shocked. And I thought he's sick. And it was really, you can see how really my village, my life in village, it was so far from real set of Israel life as community. And I would love to say, I mean, I was dreamer boy. It's mean to be, the locals people, by the way, non-Jewish community, those people called us always Falasha. It means Falasha is temporary resident. For them, even we having home, we were almost 2,000 years temporary resident of Ethiopia.
That's quite amazing. Mm. You mentioned the Bible, and as of course you know, shepherds are very important in the Hebrew Bible.
Definitely. Agreed.
Moses was a shepherd. David, King David, was a shepherd. And do you have some thoughts about how, having been a shepherd, how that work prepares a person for leadership?
Definitely. To be a shepherd boy, it's meant to be lead something, to leader. Probably our new era leader should be shepherds. Before all of them going to be a leader, us. I mean, definitely. It was really great job. I remember my silence conversation with my sheep, my dogs, my donkeys. I talked with them. We had conversation between us. I knew each of them. I got name. I gave them name. I remember even, it's really complicated to feel what it means, shepherd boy. And we had six, seven cows. I remember them, even now, I remember their name. We had very feeling connection with, I lead them. And it was my job, by the way. I made my job, and I didn't have opportunity to go school. And I woke up very early, and I took my cows, my sheep to field. It was my job. And my father said I was really great shepherd boy. I believe him. I was.
So you mean, were a very...
very good job. It's to mean to be lead something, I can't describe myself as a leader of cows, shepherds, whatever. It's like to be politics.
Well, let's try to get a look at a child, your childhood, let's say, compared with your children's childhoods. Hmm. Now, you didn't read, you didn't go to school. And in fact, the adults in your village were also not literate. But let's stick to childhood. And you had a responsible job, being a shepherd. What else characterized childhood in Ethiopia? How were children treated?
Good question. It's a little bit complicated to make compare between my childhood and my Israeli and Saba, who were born in Israel. I have four kids. My kids, all of them born in Israel, they have an exile accent, right?
Right.
And it's very Israeli, but blacks. It's very important for them. And probably we'll talk about my skin color issue. And I mean, it's for me, when I was a young boy, I mean, in my village, I took responsibility about everything. And because it's mean, my childhood was, I mean, any kids in Ethiopia, except the, I mean, I was a child, but I had a position from a little boy when I was really, really young. My mom and my father gave me a position. I did it. And because, you know, it's, I mean, to be a child in Ethiopia is meant to be employed. Okay. I got a position. Mm-hmm. I mean, my father, my parents hadn't a lot of kids. We are four kids, four boys, and we were very strongly worker boy. I mean, my father, he didn't say, okay, I have four kids. He said, I have four worker. And because, you know, this was like every parents, it's not just specifically my parents, because kids in Ethiopia is power, worker. And my kids in Israel, it's a little bit, ask them something to do it. He said, Abba, it's not my job.
Right.
And I remember even, you know, when I was a young, my father, he didn't say a lot if he wanted to do something. If he wanted to ask something from us, he didn't say nothing. It was just, you know, he focused, say, guys, do it. And I remember I did very quickly. Here in Israel, I have a long negotiation with my kids.
Right.
I mean, this is long negotiation to do something, even to make to do homework. It's just like, I mean, it's like I have at home negotiation, like Israeli-Palestinian negotiation every day.
Right, right. you mentioned the prejudice that the Jews of the village experienced, that they were, after almost 2,000 years in Ethiopia, they were referred to as residents, falashas, foreigners, basically. Talk a little bit about the other groupings in Ethiopia, if you will, ethnic, racial, religious makeup. What, perhaps in your village you didn't have a lot of other people, but maybe you did. Tell us about how that is. What's the diversity of the population in Ethiopia?
Definitely. I mean, in our neighbors, we lived a separate Jewish village from another ethnic groups, Muslim, Christian, and others. And we had, to be honest, Lee, we had really great relationship with our neighbor, with Muslim, and with Christians. All of them, those people, non-Jewish community, they knew about our religion. For example, on Shabbat, it's a great opportunity. And our neighbors respect us always, right? On Shabbat. I mean, those people now in the Jewish community, in the Jewish village, stopped to work from Friday afternoon until Sunday morning, something like that. And we had great, the best friend of my father, right, were all of them was Christian and Muslim. We had really great relationship. We didn't suffer by anti-Semitism active because we were a Jewish community. I don't remember myself. I asked my parents about anti-Semitism or something like that. My father said, yes, those people called us Falasha, but because we describe ourselves as a Falasha, said we are temporary people. We were temporary resident almost 2,000 years. The local peoples in Ethiopia, non-Jews local people, didn't call us, unreal things. And those people respect us, we respect them. And even, you know, when we decided to leave, when we left our village, my father shared with few of them this huge secret. He told them, non-Jewish and Muslim and Christian, he shared with them, said, the God sent us Mossad community, Mossad people to take us, and we have to leave to Jerusalem. And we had really, really great connection, relationship. And the government is another issue. But, you know, we have to know the Ethiopian Christianity is really different than another Christianity around the world. It's more closer to for Judaism. Even if you remember Emperor of Ethiopia, Haile Selassie, he called himself as a Jewish. He describes him, he came from Judah tribe. He said, I am very proud of Jewish from Sheba Queen, something like that. And in the end, I mean, we had really great connection, great relationship.
And yet you write in your book, and I was appalled to read it, that early marriages were often arranged by Jewish parents because they were afraid that their girls who were unmarried would be raped by their Christian and Muslim neighbors from neighboring villages.
Yeah, definitely.
So I guess both things were true.
Definitely. It was true. Many of Ethiopian community, definitely shouldn't, you have to know. I mean, one thing is we suffered by very strongly religion community from Christianity and Muslim, right? And all of them blame us always, okay? You know, the government, for example, didn't give us as a Jewish lands. Okay, they didn't give us nothing. I mean, because those people, the government knew we are not real resident of Ethiopia. We are temporary because we are Jewish. And it's really complicated to say, I mentioned about our neighbor, but I didn't say, it's really complicated to say, it's neither Christian people in our area. Definitely in our neighborhood, we had great relationship, but the generally, if you talked about, if you mentioned about Ethiopian as a Christian and Muslim community, many of them didn't like us, definitely. And what I mentioned on my book, it was really true, definitely. You can see a lot of, you know, my mom, for example, she got married with my father when she was 11 years old.
11, wow.
Yeah, she was 11 years old. And you know, because, this is average age of Ethiopian youngest girls, many of them varied between 9 to 12, because it was a specific technique to save them from rapes, from another different attacks. Yeah, unfortunately. My mom, she's still with my father many, many years, and she's really the best woman, I think.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I believe.
Let's talk a little about the journey from Ethiopia to Israel, or Jerusalem, as you and your family and everyone there referred to the whole country. You had to walk from your village to Sudan. And what you found when you got to the refugee camp in Sudan was pretty bad. Tell us about your own and your father's traumatic experiences at the Sudanese border.
Let's start something, you know, one of them, a huge problem of Ethiopian community before we left and start to walk to Sudan, Sudan, and before, you have to know, all Israeli former leaders, and specifically, to be specific, in the labor parties in the Mefleget Avoda in Israel, didn't recognize us as a Jewish, and the Ashkenazim rabbis didn't recognize us as a Jewish. Since the state of established in 1984, and only in 1977, if you remember, after Mr. Begin became as a prime minister, he was the first Israeli prime minister decided to recognize us as a Jewish, which Rabbi Uvadia Yosef is Sephardim chief rabbi. In 1979, by the way, Mr. Begin, he invited the chief of Mossad and other agencies, and then they gave them opportunity to tell them, by the way, go to bring Ethiopian Jews to be part of Israel society. And let's talk about my personally journey. And I remember it was Rosh Hashanah night, on Friday night. And we didn't know nothing about
that. You're talking about leaving Ethiopia?
Yeah.
And walking to Sudan.
We didn't know nothing. And I remember myself and my father, he walked up us around, I don't know, 1 o'clock after midnight. And he sold out everything we had. You know, we hadn't a lot of things, but yeah. But we didn't understand why. We worked up my brothers and I, and to get out from our small house, very, very ancient house, and we saw around 700 people, my old friends, my old Jewish neighbor, and we saw them outside ready to go. And we didn't know to where. Kids, children, a lot of people, we didn't say nothing. It was really quiet, silence. We started to walk a long way. And after 3-4 hours, it was the first time someone said, okay, guys, we starting our journey to Jerusalem. To Jerusalem, it's going to be a long way, but yeah, after 2,000 years, this is our moment. You should be strong. You should save your kids, your family. It's your opportunity to get to Jerusalem after 2,000 years. It was the first time I saw my father cried. I mean, my whole life, I didn't see him when he cried something. He didn't cry. I mean, I haven't opportunity to see him. When he started to cry, it was really, I shocked my father, my hero. It was said, wow. And I asked him what happened. He said, yeah, we are living now and to Jerusalem. You couldn't believe?
Enormously and, dramatic, really. Yeah, just yeah. Fantastically.
And we started our journey, and we didn't know how long and tour, how it's going to be difficult and complicated for our life.
And what did you find when you got to Sudan? Do you remember?
Nothing. It was, you know, and I mean, we walked by barefoot around 800 kilometers. We walked, and it was shocked. And after a month, a week, we arrived in Sudan. We didn't know nothing was going on because no one told us what's next. What? I mean, we didn't know nothing. We just arrived. And the local Sudanian soldier received us, and they gave us a tent, the white tent. And I remember in the first picture I saw a lot of white tents. It's an empty area, desert. I mean, I was really shocked. I was thinking it's Jerusalem. No, it's not Jerusalem. And it was in Sudan when we arrived, and the Mossad agent came to. It was the first white man I saw in my life, and he came to our tent as a doctor. He wasn't a doctor, and. He told us he's going to be here in a refugee camp a month. Don't worry about that. And we stayed a year. Mm. And we lost a lot of people. Majority, you couldn't find any family, an Ethiopian family, who didn't lost someone there. It was really hard and complicated. We had a small Auschwitz. We suffered. And we lost a lot of friends, kids, and even my parents, my father, he lost his lovely sister. And she stayed behind her two kids. One of them was, that time he was a year and a half. I mean, no, who, I mean, Operation Moses, it was complicated. Unfortunately, after we arrived, and almost four decades, we had an opportunity to tell our history, our journey. We were really, really busy to be part of Israeli society, to struggle to be part of Israeli society. We want to be Israeli. The government, Israeli government, decided to change our name from our real name, Ethiopian Jewish name, to the Israeli name. And the government decided to change my name from Adino to Dani.
And changing your name was one part of the culture shock of arriving in Israel. So tell us a little bit about what it was like to come to Israel having never seen a refrigerator or a toilet, or as you had already met your first Jewish person who was white. But
I was really shocked. I'm still shocked, to be honest. Well, I mean, Well, I mean, it was, I was really shocked. I was really shocked because I remember my first shoes. Someone gave me in Markasklita of Arad. It was you know, do you remember I mentioned many times about Jerusalem, and when we arrived, we didn't go to directly to Jerusalem, and the first the government decided to take us Arad. Like Jerusalem, so far from Jerusalem. Anyway, we were really shocked. And it was my first time I saw a building. It was the first time I saw a fridge. And I remember we didn't touch a fridge at least 3 days. We touched the house of someone. And we didn't know how to use to buy gas and buy everything. And we were really, it was really shocked. And I remember that the government took us and put us on fifth floor. And my father said, what's going on here? What you can do? And we were really shocked.
So you had never seen a staircase before?
No. Uh-huh. Definitely no. And how to use it by a toilet,
right?
You know, I mean, I taken the first book of the Bible, Genesis book. It was our village.
Right.
The gap between us and Israeli society, our real life in Israel, it was at least 300 years difference.
Now,
it
usually
was unreal. I mean,
usually children adapt faster than
Definitely.
Adults.
Yeah.
And often in immigrant groups, women adjust before the men because they have to deal with the food shopping and getting to a doctor and getting the kids in school and all of that. What happens to immigrant families like yours when the kids adapt first and the women as well and more successfully than the men? What happens to family life?
Well, my mom, she better than my father. And after 4 decades, my mom, she knows everything. She got driver's license. She know how to speak Hebrew. She has the friends, non-Ethiopian friends, white, whatever. She knows everything. My father, probably he left his village, but he's still in Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. And for men to be a new immigrant from different era is complicated. And definitely my parents, for them, the journey didn't end. They still continue for them. Because, you know, yes, they had dream to get to Jerusalem one day. Almost 2,000 years, okay, we were sending to next year to Jerusalem, in Jerusalem, but definitely we didn't know nothing how really Jerusalem complicated for our life. How will our journey continue? And he didn't know how to speak, my father, in Hebrew, and he didn't talk about what happened in Sudan refugee camp. And how really he was suffered there. And, but, you know, in the end, it's all refugee people, I mean, who immigrate as adult, it's really complicated for him. Definitely for people came from a different country. And my parents came from different world. And it was my position, and even my parents haven't opportunity to talk with Israeli society about their journey and about their life, about their culture and their traditional. And because they're different language, because they're different, the culture different, something like that, it was my position to talk about this life. And even for us, as the youngest, who made Aliyah as youngest, it was complicated. I mentioned before, because we came when you know, what's mean? Do you, if you remember, the government decided to change our name. Even there, my parents' name. My parents was born a Yidek, and the Jewish agency decided to call him, they gave him a new name, Yuda. What does it mean? What does it mean to change the name of your kids? The government said, for my father and my mom as well, you are not important anymore. You done your job. We, as a government, we know better than you what your kids need.
And is that how your parents interpreted it?
Yeah.
Because the reason I ask is it's classic in America's stories of immigrations of Jews and other groups. The experience of having their name changed when they come into the country, mostly, that's the mythology in America, mostly because the immigration clerks are not familiar with those foreign names. So they say, okay, I can't pronounce that. Your name is now Joe Smith. So, but your family felt it to be insulting or diminishing
Renee,
in some way.
Renee, you should remember, you have to know that when I have 4 kids, like I said, I know why I decided to give each of them his name. Name is something parents decided together because it's really important for them.
Of course.
It was a reason why my mom called me Adino. It was important reason for my father why he decided to call me Adino. When the government, you know, after 2,000 years, after a long journey, we got to Israel and the Israeli government said, no, welcome to Israel. From now, we'll give you a new name. We're going to change the names of your kids. You are not important anymore. We are a boss.
Danny, you write with some resentment about having to feel grateful to Israelis who endangered themselves in order to rescue you and thousands of others. You write that they are heroes and that you and other Ethiopian Jews, are not given credit for all you have endured. That the rescuers are given credit, but the people themselves are not. On top of that, Israel, the magical, wonderful Jerusalem, object of 2,000 years of longing, turned out not to be the paradise you imagined back in Ethiopia. You found a country of ordinary, flawed human beings and lots of difficulties, as you've described, many of them common to people who immigrate to cultures very different from the ones they left, including, but not exclusively, racial prejudice. So how do you personally deal with that resentment without letting it poison your joy and appreciation for your present life? What's your secret?
You know, when I started my journey to be a journalist in Israeli IDF radio, it was because someone gave me opportunity. As a refugee, as an immigrated, who migrated as a Zionist, right? I'm Zionist. I'm not immigrant. I'm here. I'm returned to home. Israel is my real home. It's
yes.
My home. And In the end, Israeli societies is very, very tribes community, very tribes society. You can't see Ashkenazim and Sephardim and the British and Americans, American, you know. And Ethiopian community, unfortunately, we haven't really, by the way. I mean, we haven't power of economic and politics, right?
Right.
But we need people. Israel society can get a lot of very, very nice people. I remember when I was a soldier, my officer, his name Moshe Shlonsky, was a very famous journalist. He took me as a project. He said, I'm going to help you. You should be journalist. I know. But he pushed me. And finally, I believe my parents is my hero. Even unfortunately, my mom and my dad didn't read even one article from my thousands of articles I wrote about Israel society, because they didn't know how to read even their mother tongue. It's really hard for them. But we're looking for opportunity. My community looking for opportunity. My community would love to be part of Israel society, which out skin color. For us, my color is like color of water. I don't care. I'm a Jewish. My feelings very, very strongly Jewish. We would love to be part of Israel. You can't see a lot of my aides from my community. Many of them believe to serve Israel society and army and other different things.
And a member of Knesset as well.
Members of Knesset, the minister.
Politician.
I mean,
right?
Politician, definitely. You can't see. I mean, if you remember, Rene, I just mentioned before the gap between us and Israel society. Past almost 35, almost four decades, you can see how really our community, right, succeed in Israeli society. Even can see myself, okay, I'm real witness of this life. And I had an opportunity to ask from my parents anything. No money, no help for homework, something to do homework together, something like that. You can see. But in the end, you can see a lot of doctors in the hospital, the judges, in the politics, and officers in Israeli army. I mean, if Israeli society, and the girl, I don't think so. It is position of government. It's position of society. It must be society. We don't need government. By the way, in the end, I mean, you can't see the kids from school and an army and I don't know, partner of you worker is Ethiopian. You can't ask him, push him, help him. Little bit complicated for him because they're different culture, different language, but something like that. And I'm here because two different people pushed me up. They give me a lot of power. And I didn't have opportunity to give up because of them. I had really sometimes I got a hard time. I didn't understand a lot in the army. It was really complicated for me. Many my partners in the army came from very richest community. But two different people, one of them it was my officer and another it was someone. They give me a lot of power. Said, Diani, you can do it. You can do it. We are here for you as a parents. Are you parents? Yeah.
So you had individuals who gave you opportunities.
Definitely.
And who believed in you.
Yeah.
And
you
must take some credit yourself as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yes, definitely. Rina, I agree with you. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I had very emotionally power to continue to be a journalist. I wanted to change the world. You know, it's like the model man, woman. I mean, I have a dream. I wanted to be part like everyone.
Yeah. And that dream and that drive and a little help and maybe a little luck.
Exactly. Definitely. Yeah. It's really, really good. I remember my, you know, when I was, when I started to work as a journalist in Ediot Haaretz, one of the biggest newspaper in Israel. And I couldn't call to someone to ask him something. Even I couldn't call to my father, my mom. And I was really, I cried a lot. I was young and beautiful, I think so. I was beautiful. And it was really hard for me. But when I had a hard time, I had the opportunity to call non-Ethiopian community to ask them help. And it's really hard because to be Ethiopian, a young man like me in 20 something years ago, it was really hard because, you know, it's our narrative as an Ethiopian Jewish. The Mossad agents did a lot for us. It's thank you. But my real heroes was my parents. They were my parents who walked.
And you tell a wonderful story.
Yeah.
About the time your father met and chatted with the late author, the Holocaust survivor, Aaron Appelfeld. On the surface, they could not have appeared more different, one African, one European, as you wrote, two men who went through hell to get to the promised land. Tell us about that experience.
Well, wow. Yeah, it's really hard.
Hard to describe?
Yeah.
Well, then I guess our listeners will have to buy your book and read it there.
Definitely. Thank you.
So finally, Danny, what do you imagine your life would be like today had you remained in Ethiopia?
Wow. Definitely. Definitely, probably, I got very simple life, like my parents. And probably I got 10 kids.
10 kids, yeah.
At least, yeah. I need worker.
Uh-huh.
And now I have 4 kids. This is really, really, it's a lot for Israeli life. It's very expensive because in Ethiopia, kids is very cheap, you know.
Right.
Well, I was continuation of Ethiopian Jewish dream, definitely, and I was continue to dream, and like my parents and like my grandparents said, "Beshana haba'a bi'ushalai." Next in Jerusalem, yeah.
Well, amen. That's a wonderful point for us to stop on. Danny, it's been great talking with you. Your story really deserves to be known and learned from. I wish you lots of good luck with your work going forward. And thank you for being on the show today.
Renee. Thank you so much. It's a great opportunity to be here. I am really appreciated. Thank you so, so much.
And thanks to our researcher, Bela Pasikoff. Bye-bye.